Wonderful. Well, thank you all for attending. We'll go ahead and get started now. My name is Brent Flam. This is session 154, titled A Reading of the Winning Essays from the 2018 Eugene England Memorial Personal Essay Contest. So just a reminder to silence your cell phones if they're not already on silent. And there's actually a lot here for me to go over. I'll just kind of skim through it real quick. But just as a reminder, we're here to explore what it is to be a part of the Restoration tradition. What does the history say? What does the theology say? And at the conference, we encourage you to explore what it means to be associated with the Mormon movement. We ask that you reflect on your own Mormon interactions and hold the good and the bad together to create a more full, complete personal narrative. So if you guys haven't done it already, we do ask you that you sign up for the conference app. It's called WHOVA, W-H-O-V-A. If you guys haven't done that, I actually really like it. You're able to schedule out your entire day and see all the, just so you have a complete full agenda. And then there's also a lot of different social things in there as well to help you kind of connect and network with people after the show and in between sessions. So this is a 90-minute presentation. And we ask that that everyone keep that within, keep that in mind as we're presenting, and then also as we have questions at the end. So let's just jump right into it, a little bit about the session. So the winners of the 2018 Eugene England Memorial Personal Essay Contest will come and read their essays. So the honorable mention was titled The Gods Step Out of Their Hiding Place, Meditations on Divine Presence. This was written by Tyler Chadwick. A flock of doves, Walt Whitman, and Emma Lou Thane come together in this meditation on how words guide the soul and the community is a part of. Tyler Chadwick lives in Ogden, Utah, with his wife Jess and their four daughters. He teaches writing at Utah Valley University and is the editor of Fire in the Pasture, 21st Century Mormon Poets, Peculiar Pages. He's also the co-editor of Dove Song, Heavenly Mother in Mormon Poetry, Peculiar Pages, and author of Field Notes on Language and Kinship, Mormon Artist Group. We'll then hear from second place, Fledglings by Dana Patterson. Raising daughters in the LDS Church and in America is a difficult undertaking. Among the tools one needs to succeed are seagulls, Star Trek, and King Lear. Dana Patterson is the author of If Mother Braids a Waterfall by Signature Books, coming out in 2020. Her creative work has appeared or is forthcoming in Poetry, Agni, Crab Orchard Review, Hotel America, Passages North, Sugar House Review, Western Humanities Review, and Zone 3. She is a founding editor-in-chief of Psaltery and Lear, a former managing editor of Bellingham Review, and poetry editor for Exponent 2 magazine. She is co-editor of Dove Song, Heavenly Mother in Mormon Poetry, and she can be found at danapatterson.com. And then we'll hear from the first place winner, The Process of Staying by Susan M. Hinckley. For many people, it looks like Hinckley, with her independent ways, is in the process of leaving the LDS Church, but she argues that she's actually in the process of staying. Susan M. Hinckley is an Arizona artist, writer, and a graduate of the University of Utah. She enjoys desert living, creating the webcomic Gray Area, moderating Waters of Mormon Facebook group, and endless examination of both her faith and her lack thereof. All right. At this time, we'll turn it over to Tyler.
Honorably mentioned enough to go first, I guess. The gods step out of their hiding place. Meditations on divine presence. Here is the efflux of the soul. Whitman. Prologue. My mind thrumming against the pulse of footfalls on asphalt, bird chatter swelling as sunlight stole into the suburban neighborhood, a dove sat down in the middle of the road, just half a block before me. A companion soon followed, and they circled each other, stooping to peck the ground, then strutting a step or two and stooping again. The bird's arrival ruptured my movement-induced reverie, not so much as to break the rhythm of my run, but enough to make me aware of my imposition on the road. I sidestepped toward the curb to avoid them, checked my watch, and quickened my pace. The clock's demands notwithstanding, the gravity of the dove's sudden presence held my thoughts. Half a block past the encounter, I glanced back, then ahead, then back again, giving way to curiosity and serendipity, to the potential symbolism of the moment. I slowed to a walk and returned to watch the birds. To record the occurrence for my daughters by taking some pictures with my phone. They would be excited, I thought, to know what I had seen while they slept. As the doves crossed lanes, making for a nearby driveway, a Jeep passed. Its heavy engine assaulted even my ears, and I thought it would startle the birds to flight. But they continued undisturbed. Their contentment called me after them, and I followed to the driveway, lagging behind and watching as Their contentment called me after them, and I followed to the driveway, lagging behind and watching as they stopped to pick at a pile of birdseed spilled near the lawn edge. Squatting on the sidewalk easement 6 or so feet from the feeding birds, I looked on and took some pictures as they each stooped to gather seed, then stood to regard me, then stooped again. At one point, the dove farthest from me skirted behind its companion and resumed its feeding ritual from the edge of the spill nearest me. I'm not sure what prompted the move. The prodding of providence, curiosity, instinct, a change in the breeze, access to more desirable seed, etc. Neither am I certain what significance to assign our brief encounter, nor even that it need be assigned great significance. Isn't it enough, I ask myself, to have crossed paths with these doves, to have been allowed by what seemed their obvious socialization with humans to regard them and to be regarded by them from a distance that may have threatened more skittish birds? Wasn't it enough to have been present with them for a moment, to hold them in my mind as they may have held me in theirs? Why should our convergence need to have meaning? Couldn't our coming together have been meaning enough? 1. Conference of the Birds. Long ago, the world's birds gathered to consider their need for a king to protect them. Listening to their desire, the hoopoe stepped forward, the crest of spiritual knowledge on her chest, the crown of faith on her head. Playing to the crowd's rapt attention, she declared that by virtue of her esoteric knowledge, her experience with the mystical realm, and her unique gift for divining underground sources of water, and for therefore sustaining life, she had learned where their rightful king lived. "Who," she asked, "will join me in a quest for the sovereign bird?" A host of anxious birds in tow, the hoopoe led a long and fearful journey toward the king, telling stories to inspire hope and focus attention. Yet as the quest exposed the diaspora to environmental extremities, which exposed the bird's individual weaknesses and provoked communal crises, many followers faltered and left the company or died. Only 30 of the millions who began the journey made it, travel-weary and impoverished, to the royal court, where they petitioned for access to the royal presence, but got shunned instead by the court steward. Placed again in extremis so near their objective, they wept and wailed at their loss. Their grief and longing worked the steward's pity. He granted their request, parting the curtain to the sovereign. However, exposure to the king's glory confronted the birds once again with their inadequacies, rupturing their expectations of a blissful rendezvous. The sovereign couldn't protect them from themselves, they realized, and in their flawed condition, they couldn't abide the potency of his being. Faced with this hard truth, each abandoned ego and gave way to self-dissolution, being reduced to dust by their encounter with an overwhelming other. But self-loss can, when rightly contextualized, catalyze self-revelation, other consciousness, and an expanded sense of personal and communal agency. After the birds, following the hoopoe, had been tried on their path to the king, and once in his presence purged and purified from all earthly elements, the fullness of his being opened before them. Its abundance restored their individual and communal health, drawing them into intimate relation with each other and with the material and immaterial worlds, within which they became, at once and for all others, traveler, guide, and path. 2. Song of the Open Road. Independence Day, or thereabouts, 1855, a watershed day for American poetry. At the time, at least one person knew it, Walt Whitman, a Long Island journalist, publisher, teacher, and poet who some 50 days earlier had registered the title Leaves of Grass with the U.S. District Court in New York's Southern District. Since early spring, Whitman had been printing the manuscript to which his title was attached, spending each day at a Brooklyn printing shop where he set much of the book's type himself and paid out of pocket for much of its printing. The manuscript represented half a decade of poetic inspiration, which later turned obsession as Whitman revised and expanded his opus across five more official editions over the next 26 years. Whitman's sewing yielded a widely influential American epic, though through it he introduced a new kind of poetry into the world's lyric landscape, one that sprawled across the page as it sprawled across the land, seeking to embrace, embody, and respond to the expanding country's varied social, cultural, economic, and geographical landscapes and rhythms. And while Whitman initiated an innovative verse form, because the land and the evolving landscape of American labor feature so prominently in Leaves of Grass, the work falls broadly within the Georgic tradition. Georgic, noun, from the Latin Georgix, to work the earth, a poem of the land. In such poems, the poet works the earth and its diverse lifeways into lyric rose. In Leaves of Grass, Whitman uses language to represent and interact with life's rhythms, demands, products, and processes, which often appear in lists and that seem intended to evoke in readers an experience of the thing. Take, for instance, this five-line excerpt from the second section of Song of Myself, the book's longest poem and the core of Whitman's poetic vision. The smoke of my own breath echoes, ripples, buzzed whispers, love root, silk thread, crotch, and vine. My respiration and inspiration, the beating of my heart, the passing of blood and air through my lungs, the sniff of green leaves and dry leaves, and of the shore and dark-colored sea rocks and of hay in the barn, the sound of the belched words of my voice loosed to the eddies of the wind. With a brisk list of things expanding like echoes, like ripples, into a more descriptive catalog of corporeal events expanding into a breath-length utterance, the poem's speaker weaves words into rhetorical structures that can be experienced as enacting at least three things. First, the grounding influence of deep breathing, which slows the hyperventilating body into its natural rhythms and deepened awareness of the sensory world. Second, the consciousness expanding that can accompany the first thing, wherein a potent sensory experience ruptures the mind, narrowed by perpetual self-focus, and opens a seam into the world's otherness. Third, the processes of exchange and growth that constitute life, the give and take of sex, breathing, circulating blood, interpreting and responding to the sensory world, language making. While the poem addresses and invokes each of these processes, the latter seems to be one of its primary concerns. I read it as mulling over the question, how might acts of language call us to share the labor, intellectual, emotional, spiritual, physical, rhetorical, required to cultivate more sustainable relationships with each other and with the earth? Such poetic cultivation seems to me a fruitful response to an environment that, without prompting, produces thorns and thistles. Hence, Adam and Eve's efforts, rhetorical by nature, to maintain the earth and their place thereon by tilling the ground, marking it with tools, by naming its products and processes, and by chronicling their movements through the wilderness. And hence Whitman's Poem of the Road, which first appeared in the second edition of Leaves of Grass, and a Song of the Open Road in the fourth edition. The poem's opening line captures an impulse that seems to run deep. Afoot and lighthearted, I take to the open road. Once upon a time, Adam and Eve felt the pull familiar to the poet, familiar perhaps to many of us. Exiled from paradise, they wandered in search of belonging, which they found to a degree as they settled into wilderness living and learned to work the earth together, to lean into its rhythms, rising to labor when it turned them toward the sun, retiring when it turned them away, letting plots produce or go fallow as the soil demanded, sowing when the warm land could gestate seeds, and reaping before the frost bit too deep. Yet, despite finding place in the wilderness, the language of paradise held their hearts and tongues. Its etymology slipped through blood, sweat, soil, and seed, bedding down in Adam's almanac of names begun in the garden and revised and expanded with Eve in the Georgics of their kinship with one another and the land. Genesis tells how even though they had settled into the rhythms of this relationship, marking the earth, reaping crops, making words, and bearing children who followed the pattern set by their parents, Adam and Eve still took shelter in the shadow of God's voice. Sounding outward from the garden, God's song stirred the pair to worship and movement. Camarados, I imagine God saying in the guise of Whitman, I give you my hand. I give you my love more precise than money. I give you myself before preaching or law. Will you give me yourselves? Will you come travel with me? Shall we stick by each other as long as we live? 3. Woman of another world, I am with you. Emma Luthane may be one of contemporary Mormonism's best-known unknown poets. I say unknown because many Latter-day Saints won't know her name, let alone her poetic accomplishments, as someone whose life and work, Jeffrey R. Holland said at her funeral, made people see themselves more clearly, joyfully, and fiercely than they would have otherwise. And I say best known because most Latter-day Saints at least recognize her lyrics to our well-loved hymn, Where Can I Turn for Peace? So while Thane's name and work aren't widely recognized among Latter-day Saints, her voice floods Mormon congregations worldwide when they echo her petition, Where, when my aching grows? Where, when I languish? Where, in my need to know, where can I run? Where is the quiet hand to calm my anguish? Who can understand? He, only one. Prompting individuals and congregations to seek someone to be with them in their woundedness, introspection, and reaching for divine connection, Thane's hymn lyrics, like her life, can be understood as an agency acting to gather disparate voices into communion and to thereby enable movement toward individual and community renewal and reception of grace. Thane can be seen making a similar move in her lesser-known poem, Woman of Another World, I Am With You, which originally appeared in Eugene England and Dennis Clark's anthology, Harvest, Contemporary Mormon Poems. Here's the poem. You, woman of different tongue, awaken me. Speak in the language of light that flutters between us. Open my heart to your dailiness. Give voice to your fears and celebrations as you wonder at mine. Your family becomes me. The substance of what you believe colors my view. You take me on. Here's my hand. Filled with yours, it pulses with new hope and a fierce longing to let that light that guides us both tell me where to be. While the longing performed in Where Can I Turn for Peace settles into the speaker's recognition that Jesus alone can fully sustain her, Woman of Another World opens toward deeper longing, the kind that can stir within when you encounter someone whose otherness feels both familiar and expansive. Such otherness feels familiar because it invokes your difference, the way in which you, like the other, are like nobody else. And it's expansive because it presents you with a field of experience and thought and with habits of thinking and being that differ from and that as such have potential to augment your own. Encounters with otherness thereby open channels through which the grace of difference, if you're willing to receive it, can flow into and enhance your being in the world and your ability to be with and sustain others. Within religious systems, conceptions of deity seem to hold out these possibilities. Gods are, after all, other than human. Their presence in our religious narratives exposes us to modes of being that differ from ours in vital ways, and that through their difference challenge us to interrogate our souls and to develop the attributes of godliness. Take Enoch's encounter with a weeping god, for instance. In his ascension narrative offered in the Book of Moses, Enoch encounters a deity so immersed in the tangle of human relationships and so invested in the ebb and flow of human history, tragedy and grief, as to be moved to emotional distress by human misery and suffering. Suffused with deep compassion and empathy, this God seeks to be toward others and working in relationship with them to sustain the principles of life no matter the cost. stirred by the disruptive response of this benevolent other, Enoch is moved in kind, weeping and extending his arms to embrace and lift all creation. I see Thane's woman of another world enacting such a theology of otherness, though not by reiterating mainstream Christianity's patriarchal God. Rather, the poem addresses a female subject who inhabits a world beyond the poet's direct experience and with whom the poet longs to commune. Given that this pattern manifests in Mormonism among individuals seeking the divine feminine, a concept othered and neglected in much contemporary LDS God talk, this poem can be productively brought into conversation with the Mormon doctrine of Heavenly Mother. Thane begins, "You, woman of different tongue, awaken me." So addressing this female other, the speaker can be seen doing at least two things. One, by acknowledging that this woman, per the title, inhabits someplace other than the world the poet inhabits, and that this woman is of different tongue, meaning perhaps that she speaks something other than the poet's native tongue, and or that her mode of discourse departs from the one dominant in the poet's culture, and or that the woman's being has emerged from and been constituted by or is of her native language and mode of discourse, the poet acknowledges a range of female subjectivities, which is to say that recognizing and sustaining the archetypal woman's otherness, the poet recognizes and sustains the distinctiveness of all women as of womanhood in general. Two, at the same time with the opening line's potential declarative, "You awaken me," the poet bears witness that the woman's presence and otherness enliven her consciousness, and with the potential imperative, "You awaken me," the poet invokes the woman's reviving, sustaining influence. Read in conversation with the doctrine of God the Mother, this life-giving other can be understood as an exalted woman who, like God the Father, sits enthroned in yonder heavens and thereby inhabits a sociality where she speaks, shapes, and is and has been shaped by the God's language. Longing to hear from this woman across cosmic and linguistic distance, the poet calls for her to speak in the language of light that flutters between them. For the woman to reach out via the medium of light, which in Mormon theology is a constituent element of being itself, would be to address the poet on a primal level, to speak to an eternal component of the poet's soul, to communicate spirit to spirit, intelligence to intelligence. Like words shared in grace and good faith, such communication conveys more than information. It's a mode of communion, of sharing threads of being that bind bodies and relationships primed to endure beyond fleeting associations. Participating in the persistence of these bonds and the messy, complicated realities they invite into our lives, we become susceptible to the dailiness of those with whom we relate, to borrow a term from Thane, to the constancy of the emotional, intellectual, physical, social, and spiritual demands they make on us, and the grace they offer us day after day after day. Per Enoch's theophany, such susceptibility shapes the character of God the Father, who holds himself open to his children despite the emotional burden doing so places on him. God the Mother, equal to Father in power, glory, and concern for their children, can be seen taking the same step toward us. As a divine being invested in nurturing others to their full potential, she participates in and oversees an expansive kinship network enacted to strengthen and sustain the human family. Thane's poem can be understood as acknowledging the exalted woman's role in upholding such networks and enacting the necessary functions they serve in individual and communal development when the poet tells the woman, "Your family becomes me." I take this as recognition that when the poet slips into the kinship body engendered by the woman and thereby awakens to her familial relationship with the woman, the act enhances the poet's being and identity. The bond, she seems to say, becomes her. It adorns her life and her worldview with the substance of what the woman believes, with the faith that calls the woman, despite her being othered and neglected, to extend herself to others, to reach others reaching and taking their hands, to fill them with the pulse of new hope and a fierce longing to let the shared light that flutters between them, that binds and guides them, lead them to abundant places and into abundant relationships. Reading Thane's Woman of Another World as God the Mother, Woman of Holiness, acknowledges the mother's emergence in human history and her active concern for the human family, manifestations of a divine love that calls her to reach to serve and save us again and again and again. This reading also recognizes that mother isn't a silent partner in the work of salvation, but can be understood as speaking and acting in ways other than those we've been conditioned to expect from God by long exposure to the impassible, punitive, domineering gods of patriarchal theologies and modes of communication. Rather, by speaking to and with the different tongue of feminine discourse, which seeks, among other things, to awaken listeners to their desires and to enact kinship bonds forged and sustained by persistent awareness of and openness to everyday places, relationships, and happenings, Thane's poem models the work of listening for mother's voice and looking for her in the details of our lives. So doing, it offers readers the grace of difference. It bears witness of, honors, and celebrates godhood in her eternal prototype, and seeks to expand the range of language and experience through which mother's abiding influence manifests in our culture and discourse. Epilogue. Once my youngest daughter, Jaylee, could stand and walk, she liked to perform for the family from my in-law's flat stone hearth. Standing where she had seen her older sisters stage impromptu recitals, where her mother and aunts and uncle had also performed as kids, she babbled as children do when learning language. Being part of a species with an evolved proclivity for language use, and having heard the spoken word since her ear bones developed during gestation, she instinctively learned to create the stream she heard coming from others' mouths. As she developed, she began plucking words like pebbles from this stream, and as infants and toddlers do when they handle new objects, playing with them in her mouth until her mind and tongue learned the poses needed to articulate those words. Until she learned to connect the tactile sensation of assembling a word on the tongue with the object or objects that sensation represents. As she made more connections, her first was among the word mom and her mother and me. In fact, she often called me mom in the months after she started talking. I noticed the pleasure she took both in connecting lingual sensations with objects and in knowing she had been understood by others. In knowing she had brought us pleasure through her language making. The day she first married the word bird with the robins and starlings that frequented our backyard, she stood at the back window and pointed at each animal, repeating, "Bert, Bert, Bert," with the urgency and excitement of a breakthrough. And it was a breakthrough. She was making language, which we celebrated with clapping and smiles and phone calls to grandparents, and which her sisters celebrated for months, though less frequently as her vocabulary grew, by asking her, "Where are the birds?" and watching her run to the window where she asked, "Bert? Bert?" and looked and pointed and waited for the robins and starlings to return.
Hello. My name's Dana Patterson. Thank you for being here. I'm really excited to be up here with Tyler and with Susan. You heard a lot of birds in that essay. There are a lot of birds in this essay as well. This is called Fledglings. One. After Susan lost her 20-year-old cat, Isabel, she befriended a seagull. Every morning, he watched from a safe distance as she poured handfuls of hazelnuts or sunflower seeds or macadamia nuts onto the cement windowsill that adjoined the slanted roof of Old Main. Officially, feeding wildlife was discouraged on campus, but Susan either didn't know or didn't care. Soon she had a name for both her bird and his slender girlfriend, Sydney and Sabine. Days when Susan took vacation, Sydney made himself a nuisance by repeatedly tapping at the window, demanding to be fed. Sabine was never that brazen. When we just chuckled and turned our backs, Sydney would release a sonorous cry that drowned out our phone calls and ruined our concentration. We'd rush at the window, and he'd squawk and fly off for a few minutes. And then he'd return, persistent, cheeky, with mingled fondness and annoyance, we put up with the quirks of this brash bird. In spring, Susan noticed a small gray fluff peeping its head over the edge of the roof. Keeping with the tradition of S names, she dubbed it Squirt. Slowly, it began to venture out, its downy cloud eventually giving way to the speckled plumage of adolescent gulls. Next to its full-grown parents, Squirt looked downright wretched. I disparaged the mud-brown feathers, black beak and feet next to Sydney's bright white and yellow-orange. "Well, it's a defense mechanism," Susan responded. "The darker colors help it blend into its surroundings, protecting it from predators." I immediately saw she was right. Squirt's dark feathers meshed with the dull roof shingles, rotting leaves, and mossy patches, as if its pubescent garb was a kind of invisibility cloak, shielding it from a world it wasn't yet able to take on. The dusty colors yelled, "Nothing to see here. Move along, you meat eaters." 2. Every summer, we take advantage of a local Shakespeare festival. Amateur dramatists perform in the outdoor Black Rock Amphitheater, a cozy space with an impressive dark cliff as a backdrop. In past years, we've been careful to choose comedies. Much Ado About Nothing, Twelfth Night, A Midsummer Night's Dream, prepping our daughters in advance by reading tales from Shakespeare. This year, however, the repertoire is hailed as The Summer of Blood and offers us slim choice, Titus Andronicus and King Lear. I think of Shakespeare's earliest known play, Lavinia's rape and dismemberment, followed by the Sweeney Todd revenge plot. By comparison, an old man sliding into madness feels subdued. On the short car trip, I discuss the bones of the plot with the girls, having left tales at home. Confident they'll be able to handle a fractious family's squabbling and demise, certain they're mature enough. Something nibbles at the back of my mind, but I don't let it trouble me. Until the end of Act 3, when I remember about the eye gouging. Gloucester, in this production played by a woman, is cornered by Lear's daughter Regan and her husband, the Duke of Cornwall. They accuse Gloucester of treason, and we watch as servants strap her to a chair and tilt her backwards against a table. She thrashes and cries for mercy for what seems like ages. I prickle in my seat, acutely aware of my daughters. I silently hope there isn't too much gore, but the Duchess has been tilted back so long that my hope dies. And indeed, when the servants cant her chair forward and step back to reveal their handiwork, fake blood rivers down her cheeks, drenching her white blouse. And what's more, there's an eyeball dangling from its fleshy cord. The audience gasps. My daughters go rigid in their seats. One of them blanches, shrinking into my side. "It's okay," I hurriedly whispered. "Remember, it's just acting. That's not real blood." As if to counter my efforts, a stream of red jets across the stage as Cornwall stabs a servant who tries to intervene. And then Cornwall holds Gloucester's other eyeball aloft before dashing it to the ground and grinding it with the heel of his boot. 3. It was a week before my 11th birthday when I had my first period, I tell them, trying to walk that fine line between too little and too much. I was so excited and proud, I say. I held up my panties so my stepmom could see the drop of dried blood. Too much? For some women, it doesn't hurt at all, but because you're my daughters, it'll probably hurt like hell. Too much. I explain about PMS and extra pimples, heat packs and ibuprofen, never on an empty stomach, I warn. If you don't have any pads or tampons, you can makeshift a pad with toilet paper. I show them how, twisting it around my two fingers. Any questions? 4. As our Friday night ritual, we snuggle together for an episode of Star Trek. The title flashes on the screen, Violations. A few minutes into the show, Deanna Troi is prone on the floor, pinned there in an involuntary memory of Commander Riker. In a confusing blur, he's replaced by a telepath who recently boarded the Enterprise. Throughout the episode, this alien, Jev, proceeds to mind rape several members of the crew. forcing people to recall uncomfortable memories and warping them. The violation always results in the victim falling into a coma for several days. I squirm through the episode, occasionally making eye contact with my husband. We both grimace a little, but neither of us feels the discomfort warrants turning off the TV. At breakfast in the morning, we decide to make it the subject of our next family night lesson. "What do you do when someone touches you and you don't want them to?" he asks. "Say, please stop," they answer. "Okay, good. Yes, you can ask them to stop." My youngest chimes in, "Sometimes when you're tickling me and I say stop, Mom, you don't." "That's true," I concede. "I will try to be better." My husband continues, "What if when you say please stop, they don't stop? What can you do then?" Blank stares. "Well, if you say please stop, they should stop," my oldest answers. "Yes," we reply, "they should, but what if they don't?" We eventually drill down to the answers we need them to voice. Yell, run away, find a teacher or adult, and we wade deeper, reminding them of Deanna Troi, how she punched, kicked, clawed her attacker. "Go for the eyes, the throat, or the groin," I hear my husband say. As the words leave his mouth, I'm miles underwater. Everything blurs, darkens, spins a little like the air is liquid and I've forgotten how to breathe. I don't want to live in a world where my husband says these things. My heart is whooshing blood to my head and I sense my daughter's peach lights in a haze. It reminds me of the first time we pulled out the board game Clue to play as a family and then realized we had to explain murder and murder weapon. "How would you even kill someone with a rope?" they asked. "Would you rope burn them to death?" Oh man, they were so naive. Except this isn't a game. I don't want them to live in a world where I'm relieved that we're explaining about predators and absolutely terrified that we have to. We're wrapping up the lesson when my oldest tentatively declares, "That probably won't happen to us, though." In the poem Good Bones, dubbed the official poem of 2016, Maggie Smith writes, "The world is at least 50% terrible, and that's a conservative estimate." She tries to keep this from her children as I'm trying to keep it from mine. "Right," we intone. I'm swallowing back the bile of college rape stats, the necessary bite of Me Too narratives, the face of Ashley, age 13, under the words, "Have you seen me?" My own grim experience. "Right," we say again for emphasis. "Remember the buddy system. Remember eyes, throat, groin." I recall the end of Smith's poem. Speaking of her children, she says, "I am trying to sell them the world. Any decent realtor walking you through a real shithole chirps on about good bones. This place could be beautiful, right? You could make this place beautiful." After this difficult conversation, after walking them through one of the shittiest rooms in the shithole, part of me wants to clasp my girls tight, apologize for bringing them into a world that is at least half terrible. 5. In one of my favorite scenes from King Lear, Gloucester's son guides his blinded father to the cliffs of Dover. Gloucester is suicidal, ready to jump. His eyes are gone, his king seems doomed, and he believes both of his sons are lost to him. He is unaware that the man leading him is his faithful Edgar, feigning madness to protect himself. As they reach the edge, Edgar describes in detail what he sees below, that the crows appear as small as beetles, the fishermen as mice. Then he says, "Give me your hand. You are now within a foot of the extreme verge. For all beneath the moon would I not leap upright." Gloucester pays the man off, waits to hear him leave, and then with a final curse for the world and a blessing for Edgar, he allows his body to fall. But Edgar has tricked him. There is no cliff, only level ground. He has tricked him in order to save him. 6. Edgar has the advantage over me. I am as unable to see as the blinded Gloucester whether or not the cliff is real. Yet as a parent, I need to describe the peril in enough detail that it seems real. Later, my husband and I worry, did we say the right thing? Too much? Too little? Is eyes, throat, groin really the best we can do? We half wonder if we'll get a call from the school reporting that one of our kids has broken someone's nose. Maybe my girls will be lucky enough to elude cliffs altogether. Maybe there will be only potholes, short drops, tumbles after which they'll land on their feet, mild bruises, a broken bone. I don't have the eyes for that kind of seeing. I must proceed searchingly, saying not so much that I freeze them with fear, saying not too little that they move without caution. 7. But perhaps I've gotten the analogy all wrong. Perhaps life itself is the cliff, and living in this world is to feel one's bare toes curl off the inevitable and all too real drop. By birthing children into a perilous existence, I've already placed them at the extreme verge, a strong wind at their backs. Exhibit A, 1992, 7th grade social studies, black and white reels of Nagasaki, the baby's eye melted to pus in its socket, fall. Exhibit B, 1998, 12th grade trip to D.C., 4 hours at the Holocaust Museum, the piles and piles of shoes, fall. Exhibit C, 1991, 6th grade lunch. First boyfriend sends his buddies over with mouths full of branding irons. Their words sear into my brain. Fall. Exhibit D, 2016, 23rd grade family vacation. A mother beggar in old town Cordoba. The black, sweaty curls of her toddler. The raised cup of her whimper. Fall. 8. And yet, there must be and yet... With all the falling comes potential for something else. Deepened empathy, increased motivation for advocacy, the kind of growth that painful experience can evoke. I would never wish for the removal of exhibits A through D from my memories museum. Each downward plunge was a pivotal moment, a metamorphosis. Instead of shrinking from life's manifold cliffs, I can teach my girls about ripcords and parachutes, how to hold one's body as it falls, how to watch out for others. In other words, I can embolden them as they fledge. 9. Fledge, verb, of a young bird, develop wing feathers that are large enough for flight. Bring up a young bird until its wing feathers are developed enough for flight. 2. Provide an arrow with feathers. Mid-16th century, from the obsolete adjective fledge, ready to fly, related to Dutch vlug, quick, agile. 10. Guillemots, I don't know how to say this name. It's the name of a verb of a bird. Guillemots, I think. Guillemots have fascinating fledging behavior. The parents nest on rocky cliff outcroppings where their nestlings are protected from predators. Below them is a maw of jagged stone. And just beyond that swells the dark blue ocean. When it comes time to fly, adults call to the fledgling from the water. Others will even nudge it to the edge. The fledgling must tap into some deep, instinctual reserve to fling itself into the air for its first flight. Its parents rush to its side, wingtip to wingtip, as it half glides, half flaps to the safety of the waves. 11. My daughters are fledging. I am fledging my daughters. 12. When Gloucester wakes on the ground, Edgar puts on a new voice, greets him as a survivor, as indeed he is. His attempted self-harm has failed. Hadst thou been aught but gossamer, feathers, air, so many fathom down precipitating, thou'dst shivered like an egg. But thou dost breathe, hast heavy substance, bleedst not, speakst, art sound. Thy life's a miracle. 13. On the first day back to school, I make breakfast burritos with a generous handful of sharp cheddar and bacon crumbles. I set the plates on the table. In my peripheral vision, I note my youngest's bra strap peeking out from under her short sleeve. My oldest rejects the word bra, referring to it instead as a third of a tank top. So be it. I wet a hairbrush and smooth her stubborn cowlick. It refuses to be tamed, poking out like an unruly feather from her crown. Before she slips out the door, I slide the take-home questionnaire into her backpack. One question reads, "Describe your child in 4 words. Don't you hate those? Only 4? I wonder if this is a test to see if I can count. If I can limit myself to only four, if I can help protect the teacher's limited resources of time and focus by reining in my praise, if I am capable of mustering an objective assessment of my own child. I struggle with this question far longer than the others. I try on possibilities. Maker, writer, baker, leader. Too rhymey, too abstract, too hobby-oriented. Marches to own drum, too cliche, too abbreviated. Fragile, handle with care, too needy, directive, and possibly not true. I consider paraphrasing a Gerard Manley Hopkins poem, a dappled thing, swift, slow, sweet, sour, a dazzle, dim, too abstract again, too lofty and erudite, too many words. I decide I don't care. I ink them in the last blank space. 14. No part of me apologizes to the half-terrible world for bringing into it these bright, gangly, inquisitive, awkward, soulful, and sassy daughters. 15. I imagine in the near future, Squirt will be identical to his dad. But then I'm no bird expert. Maybe she will be identical to her mom. Her flight feathers will grow in, and after three winters, she'll lose her dark plumage. Her beak and feet will gradually lighten like a sunrise from black's camouflage to yellow's loud brilliance. Perhaps Sydney and Sabine have already taken her to the roof's edge, perched above the rain gutter and a five-story drop, instinctively knowing she was ready, that she wouldn't plummet and break her neck on the red brick below. And perhaps, like her parents, she will learn to seek. No. Beg. No. Demand what she needs from the half-beautiful world, waltzing up to a window, rapping unabashed at the glass. Thank you.
This essay is adapted from the Why I Stay address that I gave at Sunstone last year. So if you were here and it sounds familiar, that's where you've heard it before. But I'm going to read today the version that Sunstone published, which was actually published under a different title. The one that I entered in the contest was The Process of Staying. And this version is called Circles of Light. My husband likes to joke that there are almost as many versions of this essay now as there are of the first vision. You're a good person, my psychiatrist once told me. You're just not a very good Mormon. I couldn't be offended because I knew immediately he was right. It was hard to hear, but it explained a lot. In fact, his observation suddenly seemed like something I'd known for a long time. I'm naturally rebellious, for one thing. I love questions much more than I want answers, and I'm a raging nonconformist. Tell me what I have to do, wear, say, or believe, and my first reaction is always going to be, make me. I'm pretty sure all of this is in the genes somewhere. Recently, an extremely willful daughter confided, I don't know why I'm this way, but I ask the waiter for his recommendations, and no matter how good he makes the thing sound or how much I want it, I can't order it, because I'm not going to let anyone tell me what to do. I understand just how she feels. I believe my psychiatrist meant to make me feel better with his diagnostic aside, and I guess I felt a small validation in it. But it also makes me wonder why I've spent the 30 years since he said it showing up every Sunday, sitting reverently and quietly, singing my beloved hymns with real sincerity, holding callings and performing them reliably, carrying a temple recommend that should reassure me I'm handling the checklist about as well as anyone else, yet still feel that somehow, deep inside, programmed by design into my most original equipment, I'm not a good Mormon. Why continue to be one? It's a question I've been thinking about from the moment I was old enough to realize I have a choice, which makes me think there might be something to the ongoing exercise of figuring it out. I've imagined being asked from the smug seats in the middle of the chapel or on the worst Sundays, from behind the pulpit, the question aimed at my chair in the overflow, why don't you leave? Anyone can see you're in the process of leaving. You've been complaining, disagreeing, and uncomfortable for as long as we've known each other. Why don't you leave? My answer is that if someone assumes I'm in the process of leaving, they have misunderstood me. I am in the process of staying. I had a lonely childhood for many reasons, none of which are important here, but one image from it is. Sometimes at night when the house was dark and quiet and I felt most alone, I would look down from my high window at the streetlight that stood directly across from our house. It was always there, standing bravely, fending off the darkness in a circle of light it had to draw for itself on the sidewalk. It never faltered. It stood in the dead of winter, crusted with snow and ice, and in summer, too, coming on magically just as the last long rays of sunlight disappeared at the end of our street. Rather than living in the dark, it just turned on its light, creating a comfortable place for itself to stand. It surrounded itself with exactly what it needed until daylight returned and gave off enough extra to help everyone around it, too. I always felt a kinship with that lonely streetlight. Something about the way it was living felt true to me. It lived in hope. Over the years, I've come to understand that in order to have light in my life, in order to have hope, I need to draw a circle for myself to stand in. Being surrounded by love illuminates just such a space, and although I can't completely control anything, I can create love in my life for myself by loving God and by loving the people around me. By generating my own love, my own light, my own hope, drawing a circle for myself and then reliably showing up to stand in it, I not only survive, but sometimes I'm able to throw off a little extra into the darkness around me. And darkness is an important part of my story. I have felt it keenly in my life, but perhaps my acquaintance with the dark has made me sensitive to even the smallest hint of light. A light becomes more useful when the darkness around it increases. When I was 14 years old, I felt conflicted about my Mormonism, chafing against its constraints, even as I took comfort from the hope I found there. Tired of feeling pulled both ways, I picked up my Book of Mormon one night and decided to put Moroni's promise to the test. I tried to read with real intent over the next few weeks, and after I'd finished, I prayed hard. And the increase of peace I received from those prayers came with a sense of place, like looking at a map with a bright dot that said, "You are here." It wasn't an undeniable witness of truth, but it was real and personal, a witness that I was standing in my place and need only turn on my light. I still refer to this as my pesky experience with the Book of Mormon, because I've never been able to extinguish its hope. I've never wanted to, no matter how much my head insists I should. My connection to Mormonism has always felt more personal than doctrinal. We each need a certain quality of light to illuminate our darkness, and my darkness isn't born of big questions seeking big answers. Rather, it's a need to connect the small dots of my human experience and then find a connection with others. As I look back across my lifetime of membership, I see a long string of lights from which I continue to draw hope. People and ideas, feelings and experiences, a collective brightness of small things to which my heart returns when I need spiritual rest. They are uniquely mine, gifts that perhaps only I can see, but they illuminate my path and nudge me forward. There was so much to love in my Mormon upbringing. I loved the primary songs that later became lullabies for my babies, "Tell Me the Stories of Jesus" and "Little Purple Pansies" and "Whenever I Hear the Song of a Bird." Laughing at the chorister who had saggy skin wagging from her aging arms, hair piled up miles above her head, and a tremulous voice that was louder than the room was big. But even then, knowing that she had other things she could be doing, and being grateful she was there. I took comfort in her kind hand, moving up and down with each note to show us where to sing. I wanted to grow up to wear the same white patent leather boots. I loved the organ, booming its familiar hymns while my mother beat time for the congregation, her white baton swinging with feeling and her lipsticked mouth worshiping in a deep red alto O. She led the music as if God himself had called her to it, because he obviously had. I loved the kids I grew up with. The same faces year after year. Their dresses, their curled hair, their questions, their freckles, their boredom, their rebellion, their snickering, the inside jokes, the walks home after. I loved my teachers, all the unlikely ones who showed up anyway when we did nothing to earn their time or love. We listened with one ear, watched with one eye, kicked the chair in front of us with both feet, and ran our mouths nonstop in an attempt to prove that we already knew much more than anyone could teach us. Still, I remember treats in a battered aluminum pan, a handbag on the table next to an open lesson manual underlined in careful pencil, glimpses of my faith through a different mirror than the one I lived with, a flannel board, a magnet for the fridge, a token to remind me that my teacher cared, but Jesus cared about me most of all. I loved the dresses my grandma made, years of Sunday ruffles in patterns and fabrics picked just for me. No one ever had the same clothes I had. How could they? Sitting next to her in church one day, I heard her sing that God is love and realized with satisfaction. I already knew that. Somehow she and God had made it plain. I loved the fabric of our ward. Families lined up in their Sunday best, throwing off their daily lives and showing up like clockwork. Kind bishops, crying babies, missionaries who caught a Hail Mary haircut and were off to save the world, or perhaps themselves. Mothers who never doubted. Grown-ups knowing who I was and where I came from, caring where I went next. The booming man in the seersucker suit, the barrel-chested janitor, the head cheerleader, the orthodontist who loved poetry, that woman always in the second row, stick straight in a fox fur, its pointy face pinned just below hers. The same characters in every performance. Pillars of my childhood faith. There was a hint of eternity in the constancy of it. So much humanity in the details. I loved youth leaders, their hours so freely spent, the man who gave me water skiing, his zinc-white nose a legend under his threadbare hat, circling the boat as I dropped the rope again and again and again. He ignored my begging, my chattering teeth, promising if I'd try just once more, I'd see. He knew I could, even as I insisted I couldn't. He was right. I loved suddenly being old enough to sing in our ward choir. Everyone showing up at 6 a.m. Friday mornings to spend an hour lost in the wonder of God so loving the world. Easter cantatas and Christmas miracles, the battle hymn of the Republic in July, and tears on the cheeks of the conductor when we raised the last amen. And it was good. I loved the complexity, things I didn't understand, things that spoke to my heart directly, doctrines that answered one question but raised a dozen more, the secret feeling I was smarter than the teacher, the realization I knew nothing at all. Holy envy of another's truth. The beautiful language of the scriptures. Fantastic stories in equal parts faith-promoting and troubling. Ideas much too big. Light through cracks. People called good who I knew did bad things. And people called bad who I knew to be good. Prayers answered or ignored. Figuring out which rules mattered and which never would. The tree of polygamy that offended deeply, but produced good fruit, like me. Learning to walk, to keep walking, while my heart and brain wrestled it all. I loved summer reunions, ancient cousins swapping genealogy in the dappled shade of a small-town city park, picnic tables heaped with jello and funeral potatoes and six kinds of cake, the buzz of children and swatting of flies, and everyone eager for the blessing on the food. I loved the blessing itself, its familiar cadence, its second nature phrases, the thankful language of food and family, the sustenance of belonging. The moments of light that began in my childhood have continued as I've lived my Mormon life, in and out of wards, in and out of callings, in and out of belief, of faith, of hope. I gather them, I guard them. I am in the process of staying, the process of becoming myself. And I am a Mormon in ways so deep I've never figured out how to reach or turn them off. If you're going to say I'm not a good Mormon, you may as well say I'm not a good me, because I don't know how to be anything but this. For me, being a Mormon isn't a destination. It's a path, a way to something better, a process of hope. And hope is what carries me from one moment of darkness and uncertainty to my next. I'm not sure why Mormonism has always given me the kind of hope I need in order to draw my circle of light, because it gives me plenty of less desirable emotions too. But not being able to explain it doesn't make it less real, valuable, or useful. Hope is both where and how I live. Every time I act in accordance with my hope, I am shown a glimpse of my own light. Surely that's the point of church, to allow us to catch sight now and then of what is possible. Whether it is something about Mormonism or something about myself, I believe in the hope at the bottom of it all. It speaks peace to my lonely heart. Why do I stay? Because I want to be a light much bigger and brighter than I am now, and I feel it could happen if I'm willing to keep showing up with the wounded and weary and disenfranchised every Sunday, each of us a little less alone when we recognize something true in the other, standing together in a circle of collective light we draw for ourselves and anyone who needs it. As a child, I learned of loneliness and was called to turn on my light. I've been learning to use that light ever since. To be a Mormon is to be in a process of conversion, of doubt, of faith, of hope, and wending our infinite separate ways. We're always engaged in finding our path or staying on it. We're always in the process of becoming who we can be. So I stand where I am and draw my circle. I am here. Thank you.